Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week this show will address many ways of creating greater health, joy, and love for you and your loved ones. We will introduce you to top professionals and talented authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, I would really appreciate if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward at least one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from today's subject. This is one powerful way that we can make a positive difference together. And I guarantee you, we all know somebody that can benefit from today's subject. Now, I want you all to know that I am grateful that you take your time to listen to or watch this show, and especially those that send in questions, comments, reviews, and suggestions, because remember, this show exists for you. Now, if you haven't gotten your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal yet, please go to our website at answers.network or answersforthefamily.com, if you still have that in your in your computer, and download a copy. Give it 21 days and comment on whatever platform you listen to us on, what focusing on gratitude has meant for you and your loved ones. Now, our topic today, which is also the title of our guest's groundbreaking book, is Why the F Can't I Change? Insights from a Neuroscientist to Show That You Can. Now, our guest, Dr. Gabby Tolekete, is a neuroscientist and lecturer, as well as a performance and well-being coach. She currently lectures about psychology at Sheffield Hallam University, and she completed her PhD at the University College of London on neuronal basis of memory and navigation, and her PhD findings were published in one of the highest impact research journals, The Natural Neuroscience, which was in 2017. Prior to that, she undertook award-winning academic research on Parkinson's disease at the University of Helsinki. During her PhD, Gabby has also qualified as a business coach and coached UCL academics and administrative staff. Combining her neuroscience background with a coaching experience, Gabby has started her own consulting company, providing coaching and seminars for organizations and the general public on the subjects, including changing habits, productivity, leadership, and decision-making. She is also a TEDx speaker, and her work has been featured in Guardian. Gabby, welcome to Answers Network.
Hi, Alan. A pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I want you to know I had a chance to go through the book, and I really love what you're doing. And I think the timing is so good right now with everything that we're going through, talking to people about looking more inside about what we can do. I just think that, again, it's not only a great book, but it's a great time for people to read this book. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about your journey that led you to this point.
Yes, that's a brilliant question. So first of all, I always wanted to understand how human mind works. Since I was a child, my dream was, you know, to almost read somebody else's mind and to understand their behavior. And when I started university, I realized that neuroscience perhaps is the best research area to investigate that. However, during the years of my PhD, reading all these amazing research findings, I was astonished how little was shared with the general public. Mm-hmm. And I was constantly getting light bulb moments. So this could help us to understand, you know, why we feel these emotions, and this could help understand why we can't get work done after a certain time and so on. And I was drawn and inspired to provide those insights for the general public, which then led me starting the neuroscience course in schools for teenagers, public talks in London, seminars for companies and so on, where I was sharing those insights about the topics people cared about, such as productivity, decision-making, leadership, emotions, to name a few, and getting feedback of what people found useful was really surprising me. So as I was thinking, like, actually, so it's not only me thinking that they are beneficial, they actually really let people understand themselves better.
Now, what I was going to say is, I mean, why do you think that with all of the gains that we've made in so many areas of technology and medicine, why does it seem like we have not until just recently started to really look deeply into our brain and what we can do with our brain in order to change?
Well, we have had amazing insights in neuroscience over the last 100 years. Recently, there's been major breakthroughs in the research methods of how we look at the brain, healthy, well-functioning brain, and how it processes information. And that's been, you know, last 20, 30 years, provided insights in that with the fMRI method in particular. However, I think given how complex brain is, it's a lot of neuroscientists are reluctant to discuss practical applications of their findings in order for them not to sound too simplistic or too overstretched. And needless to say, some of the neuroscience insights that have been popularized has been misconstrued. So there has been like some misunderstandings between those fields. So it's not that necessarily easy to take solid neuroscience and to create practical tools. It does require a certain level of simplification. However, it requires people who actually do the research to do that, so to figure out which things can be left out and which are essential. So that has been my journey doing research, and it has been very fascinating and interesting journey, but really kind of crystallizing what the brain is, what it does and what it requires, can truly explain our behavior better than anything else I know.
Well, let's go right there. I mean, what is it that we know about our brain, and what is it that we still need to find out for us to be able to harness it ourselves? You know, as the person who has this brain in our head, I think oftentimes people have this belief that they have no control over it. Share some of the things that we can do to take better control.
So for example, the brain consists of many areas, and each of them is responsible for different tasks. Now, of course, for more complex tasks, multiple areas need to be activated. And those brain regions developed in a specific sequence in evolution, with regions being deeper in the brain, being more ancient, and they're shared with our ancestors in the reptilian kingdom. Now, on top of that, we have regions that are called paleomammalian regions, which create emotions and habits and draw us to familiarity, which allow us automatic and very quick reactions. And as the name implies, mammals have very similar regions. Now, at the very top of the brain, we have multiple regions that kind of form the neocortex or the human brain. And those are the smartest centers of our brain. Those different brain areas, they have different agenda to our life on day-to-day basis. And some of them we have no control over, such as mammalian centers and lizard brain or paleoreptilian centers, which just control heartbeat, breathing, digestion. We can't really control them. And they create things like emotions, irrational habits, what people we're drawn to, and so on. So, of course, they kind of have a big impact on our behavior. However, the other regions have a power to somewhat kind of override them, to soothe them, to calm them down. So, for example, the region at the very front of the brain called prefrontal cortex is the region that is connected to emotional centers and can calm them down. So imagine if you have really strong reaction, let's say before public speaking, and you can rationalize using prefrontal cortex and calm that down to some extent, and say, okay, well, actually not what's worse that can happen and so on. You can talk to yourself to soothe that down. However, opposite is true as well. Very strong emotions can alter and distort our rational thinking as well. So that's been one of the major breakthroughs in understanding human behavior. It's called amygdala hijack of prefrontal cortex, which amygdala being one of those centers of mammal brain. So that's just, you know, those different regions, how they interact, what they do, and how they kind of then later on create our behaviors and subjective experiences, such as emotions of those situations, can explain why with certain things we are powerless, in fact. However, we can, that's not unchangeable. We can train that communication between regions to become better, and we can calm the emotional centers and retrain them to some extent to react less and less in the future. So there is enormous plasticity in the brain, which is another huge, huge insight in the field of neuroscience. We can change those networks. We can change those reactions, given that we can change the connection between neurons over time.
Now, you mentioned irrational habits or bad habits. And I noticed in your book that you mentioned that why we shouldn't suddenly stop bad habits. And that sort of goes against everything that we tend to think is that it's, okay, I'm going to focus on this bad habit so that I can stop it. Why shouldn't we suddenly stop them?
Well, any habit we dislike, no matter how bad we think it is, it serves us somehow, or else we wouldn't do it. So in other words, all the bad habits are good in a way. They are giving meeting certain very important needs that we require. Of course, if we don't really understand what needs we're meeting with that, we can easily just dismiss and think, okay, I don't really need that habit. And then if once we try to get rid of it just with sheer willpower, what happens a day to a week down the line? We usually revert back to where we started because the need which we used to meet with a habit is left unfulfilled. There is a vacuum, in other words. So in order to actually change what we call bad habits, we firstly need to understand what is it that we're getting with them. In other words, what are the rewards? What are the needs we're meeting? Once we understood, then we need to find other ways to meet exact same need. And that's very important. It has to be exact same need. Then we need to practice enough meeting that need with a new habit till actually that becomes new norm, new familiarity for the mammal brain. And only in that way we can create a lasting change with the bad habits. And also very important, when we try to just completely quit bad habits very, very suddenly, we can trigger that amygdala hijack of the rational brain. And the reason being that your amygdala or mammal brain in general absolutely hates novelty. It hates unfamiliarity. Because if you imagine like mammal brain centers, they're like a small child. Like you imagine you just take a small child to, let's say, the shopping mall and leave the child on his or her own for the first time. They would freak out. And the same happens to our mammal brain when it's faced with unfamiliar scenarios, unfamiliar habits. So it requires small steps and kind of explaining to your mammal brain and educating mammal brain as we go along to create more and more and more familiarity. So it doesn't freak out, because it's much, much harder to do anything. Once the mammal brain freaks out, our willpower loses, because those centers, there is energy management in the brain in the way that they don't get enough energy resources to function well. So then we literally run on those irrational habits.
Well, can you walk us through, let's take a situation and walk us through something that maybe many people would relate to, like making the wrong choice for a boyfriend or a girlfriend. You know, this is something that I think many people believe that they end up in a pattern. You know, they end up in a habit. They keep picking, quote, the wrong guy or the wrong girl or whatever. So let's walk through that a little bit.
Okay. So that's a complex thing. That's not a habit. That's a series of behaviors and habits that actually lead to that outcome. So in order to change that, it's much, much longer process as opposed to, like, you know, quitting drinking coffee or eating sugary snacks, right? But let's look what steps we need to go through in order to make better choices in relationship. A, in my chapter in my book on relationships, I share a little bit about inner child theory. So that's a theory which basically, it could also be called, you know, like amygdala familiarity theory, if you like. It's kind of their synonyms. That since we are children, our brain constantly stores information, what things are good, what things are bad, what things are familiar, what things are novel, and so on. And it's naturally drawn to those familiar scenarios. Mammal brain is. Now, your prefrontal cortex, human brain, could be drawn to opposite. It could be drawn to novelty, to development, to growth, to contribution, to achieving more and more, and so on. So often, over lifetime, when we get to the dating age, we have accumulated two different ideas. So one is what your mammal brain wants in relationship, and another is what your human brain or prefrontal cortex wants. And for some people, it could be completely different things. Or for others, it could be quite overlapping if you had really healthy and harmonious upbringing. If there is huge mismatch, you'll be constantly torn. You'll think that, okay, these are the criteria of the person I want to be with, but you would feel powerless because emotionally you're drawn to completely different people. So in order to kind of resolve the conflict, it does require healing so-called amygdala traumas. And that's to kind of resolve unfinished patterns in your childhood. And that's all the inner child healing technique is dealing with. Now, after that, that work usually is quite slow and takes quite a long time. In addition to that, we have two different decision-making systems in the brain, system one, system two. System one being emotional, which is mainly run by amygdala, and system two being rational. We need to also get really, really clear that if we allow ourselves to make decisions using system one before we healed enough, we'll fall back into the old patterns. So we need to use system two and hang out around people who are meeting those prefrontal cortex criteria enough, so that becomes more and more familiar to us. They don't necessarily have to be boyfriends, girlfriends. We can be spending time and having close friendships and working with them together. So your amygdala gets familiar with that. And then once we kind of, once those two things are met, when we actually go to choose partners, if we have healed enough, and if we're familiarized with the healthier relationship dynamics more, we naturally start to make somewhat healthier choices. But the kind of hardest bit there is that brain changes and heals most in relationship. So you can't just be all enlightened and sit there and expect that you've healed everything. Mm-hmm. Actually requires getting in a relationship and perhaps making imperfect choices and working through them. But if we make just somewhat better choices each time, we'll be healing along the journey.
Right. Well, what it sounds like you're talking about is taking control of our emotions. That, you know, and I know you have a chapter in the book that talks about that. But how do we do that? How do we just take control?
We can't.
Exactly. Yeah, that's my thought. So
we can't take control, but what we can do inner work to heal the wounds, because emotions are just side effect of what's going on inside of us. And imagine if you have a lot of beliefs about yourself that you're not good enough, that you deserve this and things like that. They will be creating all sorts of emotions when you go about your day. Emotions just come and go. They don't stay there. Now, beliefs about you, they actually are harder to change, because they probably form so-called the brain highways, or very strong networks in the brain, which by default you kind of interpret and perceive the world by. So firstly, in order to change emotions, we need to change those deeper beliefs and gradually change those networks and challenge. And in the book, I share some methods, such as Byron Katie's The Work, one of the methods, which actually is very congruent with how to kind of communicate between rational and emotional centers, and how bit by bit question those beliefs and override them with more suitable and more accurate beliefs. Very important here is to realize that just plain positive affirmations wouldn't be sufficient. So if you say, okay, like if your inner belief is I'm ugly, let's say, and if you just repeat I'm beautiful, I'm beautiful, I'm beautiful, that's not going to work. But if you actually look objectively and ask people, what's beautiful about me? And people keep saying, wow, you have really amazing eyes and your hair is beautiful and look how athletic you look and so on. You suddenly have evidence for your brain why you're beautiful. And all of us are actually both. All of us have, you know, kind of certain features that are really attractive and certain features that are not. So being aware that that's how like that kind of more realistic view on benefits and drawbacks, we suddenly kind of have much more grounded base for our brain to work on. And then, you know, it would no longer, once you update that belief, let's say it was with beauty and in this instance, you would no longer be triggered about things that challenge that.
Okay. You know, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I want to get back to habits. One of the things you mentioned was like, you know, a different type of habit, like the habit of needing sugary substances. And I think a lot of people struggle with that. So for everybody, stay with us. We're going to talk about that when we come back. So remember, you're listening to Answers Network. We'll be back in 1 minute. Okay. Ronan, if the commercial's running, we can't hear it.
Are we supposed to hear the commercials?
Yeah, and I don't hear it. So let's just let's keep going on. I'm not sure what's happening. So we're back. You're listening to Answers Network. And we're going to talk a little bit more about habits and in the area of something that is, you mentioned earlier, just the need for a sugary substance, you know, to where it's, okay, somebody's gotten in the habit of every night before they go to bed, they need a dessert. They need some sort of a sugar substance or a sugar high before they go to bed. What's the best way that we can break a habit like that, which I think is going to help us, you know, emotionally and physically, our body as well. So I think it's a win-win situation if we can do that. And let's also talk about how long that realistically takes.
Well, firstly, different people eat different these sugar snacks for different reasons. So we need to really see what happens a little while before we start desiring that sugary snack. For some people, it might be that they are feeling lonely. Maybe they wish they were there in the evening with their partner, and they don't have a partner at the moment, or they might have just broken up, right? For some people, it might be boredomness. They feel unstimulated. Maybe their jobs they're in are not really kind of, they don't feel that they are meeting their potential or it's challenging enough for them. Some people might be stressed. They're so stressed. They don't have any other ways to regulate other than, let's say, have sugar snacks or drink alcohol or other medias like physical substances to change that physiology and emotional state. For somebody, it could be safety. They might feel really anxious, and eating sugar snacks help them to regulate anxiety. So again, we're coming back. We need to look at the habit loop. In any habit, there is a cue or trigger that sets the habit off. Then there is a routine, which in this instance is eating sugary snack, and there is a reward. What are you getting out of it? So let's take an instance that somebody is feeling very lonely. So they eat sugary snacks when they're lonely. So trigger was in the during the day, they're doing things, they're busy, they don't realize, you know, that the need is there till the evening, till everything comes down, it's time to go to bed, and they are acutely aware of the loneliness. Eating sugary snack usually changes physiology and also changes brain chemistry to some extent, which can soothe and calm that emotion. So carbohydrates in particular, but eating in general, help us to shift between sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system. Sympathetic being, you know, the one which produces stress and anxiety and unpleasant emotions, and parasympathetic, also called rest and digest, helping us to relax. So for that person, it's almost a kind of a way to calm themselves down enough so they can actually go to bed and not be in that unpleasant state. Now, in order to change that, we need to find better ways to meet their need. So what could be ways for somebody, for example, to feel less lonely? They might call the family member on the phone before in the evenings. Once the perhaps pandemic has eased off, they might maybe join some classes in the evenings, maybe dancing classes or gym classes where there is other people around them. It doesn't necessarily even, sometimes we meet like those social needs just by people being around us. And I think a lot of people during pandemic have struggled with that because they haven't been able to kind of just absorb that social vibe. Yeah. It could be perhaps maybe for somebody might be starting maybe online dating and starting chatting with people and having somebody to kind of, you know, who is getting interested in getting to know them and them having somebody to kind of think about and have the mind preoccupied with. Another alternative could be getting a pet and actually, you know, having somebody to look after and so on and so forth. So write down as long list as you can think of and choose one way which feels something that you would like to do. It has to be something that would resonate for you with you. And for different people, that would be different approach. Then in the evening before, like, so let's imagine you start craving sugar snacks at 7 o'clock in the evening. At 5 o'clock, do that habit, or 6 o'clock. It has to be earlier. So you don't get to the state where that need is so low that you can't help just to, you know, to flip into that habit. So do whatever that is, maybe talking to somebody on the phone, cuddling the pet or whatever other means you chose. And if you do that frequent enough, so it has to be, again, daily routine for a couple of weeks, that already should actually make a big difference. But complications are that it depends on what the trigger is and depends how much emotional things you are dealing with using this habit. It might take longer. Imagine if you're actually gone through the very, very complicated and painful divorce and you're eating sugar snacks and drinking alcohol to escape the pain. It would take a lot longer than 2 weeks to sort of be able to change that.
We have a question that's coming over right now, and it ties right into this, the issue of food, using food as comfort. And this one reads, I've had a compulsive eating disorder most of my adult life. I have tried so many things and read so many books, but something in my mindset seems to prevent me from overcoming this issue. Does your book address these type of problems? And this is from Susie in Los Angeles, California.
That's a brilliant question. So we talk, these are classified under addictive behaviors. So the hardest thing, they are quite a few steps further than what we call simple habits, because these are the habits that meet a lot of needs and become part of personality. With a lot of eating disorders, we see that personality changes as the disorder progresses. We see that in the disorders of substance abuse as well. So that makes the change much, much harder. Given the brain then reacts to food in a very different way as probably did before developing the eating disorder. I chose not to address addictive behaviors or addictions in the book, as that requires much more therapeutical approach. Mm-hmm. And I decided that that's not quite the area I'm qualified in. I didn't want to sort of, you know, jump in the field where basically I'm not working. I don't work with my clients. We don't work on those situations. So that's simple answer to this question.
Let's go into one of the areas that I know that you do touch on the book, because I read it and I found it very fascinating and very valuable, which has to do with increasing productivity. So share with us what you believe your most effective tips are for increasing productivity, something we could all use.
I don't personally like, and also from the brain perspective, one size fits all approach. So it has to be specifically what somebody really struggles with. So if somebody, let's imagine somebody really, really struggles to focus, to really focus on something they're working on, and the attention is constantly being scattered away. So in the subchapter of the productivity chapter, I discuss two different attention networks in the brain. One called dorsal attention network, which allow us to focus right now on this conversation, and ventral attention network, which would warn us if there is like fire warning or whatever other disturbances that are important to notice. Now, depending on what habits we got into, sometimes the balance between those two networks is skewed. So we need a good balance between them both. They both need to be equally strong and capable for us to be productive. If we are overly focused, we work too long, we get like really too obsessed with the task, and we deplete our brain chemistry. We get exhausted with the struggle to switch off in the evening. If the ventral attention network is running the show, we get distracted all the time and can't focus on the task. So in order, if you realize, okay, I either overfocus and get utterly exhausted and can't switch off, or I get distracted all the time, I share practical tips on how to train those networks. So for people who overfocus, they need to take breaks. They need to set reminder after 45 minutes, take a break. And even if you're in the middle of the task, unless it's a live show, for example, you're doing, you can't really take a break, right? But just kind of getting in the habit, forcing yourself to take those breaks so the brain doesn't get into that more and more focused state. For people who struggle to actually focus, then for them, funnily enough, similar tip, but actually setting a timer to work on the task and not allowing yourself to do anything else than that. So I share Pomodoro technique by Italian management consultant Cirillo. Discusses how actually very simple techniques such as setting a timer for, let's say, imagine 10 minutes. If somebody really struggles to focus, even 10 minutes of single focus task might be a challenge. And just focusing on that time, doing the task, can really help them bit by bit to train that attention network to become stronger and stronger over time. Once they can easily do 10 minutes without getting distracted, increasing timer to 15 minutes and so on. So it has to be a gradual process, because as with physical fitness, you wouldn't just run the marathon without any training. The same applies. So we really need to kind of start, okay, well, maybe I'll just walk around the block now. Now maybe I'll kind of walk a bit faster. Now maybe I'll run around the block, kind of, you know, jog around it and so on, till we actually build up to the level where those both networks are kind of self-regulating, then that's no longer an issue. Now, for other people, procrastination is an issue. Again, I discuss procrastination in the similar light as we talk about bad habits, how to identify what needs your meeting with your procrastination. And based on that, I discuss six different types of procrastinators, and there is different tips for each type, in order, based on, you know, what needs they're trying to meet. So different strategies could help them to meet those needs better.
We've got about five more minutes, but I want to make sure we touch on another chapter in the book that is leadership. And this is something that I think we are drastically in need of. I think it's one of the bigger issues that we have worldwide right now. Is we have a shortage of good leadership. So how can we be more empowering leaders and at the same time be the best influence we can be on others?
In the book, I discuss two different leadership styles, dissonant leadership and resonant leadership. Now, that's work has been pioneered by Richard Boyatzis and Tony Jack. And basically, in the brains, ultimately, very different networks are activated. With resonant leadership, the networks are activated that allow us to connect at the emotional level, to empathize, to care about others. And as the name implies, resonant leaders do care about people and they bring sort of the best in them. Now, with dissonant leaders, the network that's called task positive network activates in the brain, which mainly focuses on performance and what needs to be done, which is sometimes very important as well. Like in the situation of crisis, like imagine you have to escape the danger. That's very, very important. However, dissonant leaders really struggle to get in the mindset of another person. They struggle to form connection. And ultimately, the teams don't work very well when shared decisions are required. Now, very interesting thing is that we all have both networks, default mode network required for resonant leadership and task positive network required for dissonant leadership. And we can actively train those networks to become stronger or weaker based on what we practice. Based on our personalities and past experiences, we probably have a dominant network. So some people are naturally just fall into the more resonant style when they are in the social setting, while others stay within dissonant style. So really gaining awareness which style would be more beneficial in this situation. So does the kind of connection and understanding others is needed in the situation? Therefore, resonance style is needed. And asking yourself questions to tip into the network. What does this person need from me now? How can I help him or her? Would naturally help us to get into that network. If you tend to get too resonant and distract your, you know, like people with that, especially if the people are doing analytical tasks, they might need more dissonant style at that time. Asking yourself, okay, what does the task require? How much time do they need me to let them work on it? And so on and so forth. So more dissonant questions. Now, very last insight on that is when we are stressed or exhausted, we naturally all fall back onto the dissonant style. So managing stress and actually taking breaks as leaders, taking frequent breaks, giving yourself time to actually sit down and have lunch, going outside for some fresh air. So really kind of replenishing yourself so stress doesn't build up is very, very crucial to allow yourself to be in a state to be able to do resonant leadership when that's required.
It's interesting. As you were talking about the two different types of leadership, I actually thought of a scene from a very famous movie, which is The Godfather. And when Michael says to their attorney, and which is Tom, and he says, you're out as our attorney, or as the consigliere, you're out as the consigliere because I now need a wartime consigliere or attorney. Mm-hmm. So I need a different type of attorney or leader to take us into battle versus one that just deals with issues, you know, and stuff. So as you were saying that, anyway, that particular scene popped into my head. We've only got a couple minutes, but we have another question that's come in. And again, I want to thank those that take the time to send the questions in. This one says, I believe this pandemic and lockdown is spinning people out of control. And my experience is that once imprinted on children, these emotional reactions can be lifelong anxiety triggers. This also extends to adult friends and family who I felt were normal with the normal ups and downs that life brings. It says communication is really difficult and talking to them about mindfulness and breathing techniques isn't being received well. They get even more upset saying that I am criticizing them for what they feel are justified emotions. What do you do, or what do you feel we can do about this? And this is from Evelyn in Kansas.
Perfect question. So in general, just I can see two parts of the question. For children, the mammal brain is very, very active and prefrontal cortex is not yet developed. So in general, children and teenagers can't regulate their emotions as well as adults. So for them is normal, especially in the when there is challenges, to really have stronger reactions than we anticipate. Now, for both adults, children, teenagers, actually for all groups, now during the pandemic, we are constantly deprived of certain needs, such as connection, significance, mm-hmm. variety, novelty, you name it. So what we get in the habits basically is getting those needs from suboptimal ways, from the ways which are not necessarily very congruent with our personalities. And to be honest, during this time of pandemic, I would just, my advice is being gentle with ourselves and others. We're doing the best that we can. I think this is not really a representative period. And it would take time to heal and to get back to more empowered habits. But it's very, very hard to change that when we have quite limited freedom and limited choices. We can ourselves, if you identify within yourself that, okay, I really don't like that, I'm getting into that. And if you feel like you're in a good enough state to make better choices, work on that. But for others, we can't really assess what state they are. And if they're really in the state where mammal brain is running the show, they can't make better choices. They will when they get in a better state.
All right. Well, one of the things is, because we're about out of time, okay, where can people get the book and what is the best way for people to get in touch with you?
Perfect. So the book is on Amazon. It's easier to find a book using my name as opposed to the full book title because it has the F word. So sometimes it's kind of Amazon struggles to find it. So if people, I imagine there will be my name under the show description. If you just add my full name on Amazon, you'll find a Kindle version, you'll find a paperback version, and also there is an audiobook as well. In order to get in touch with me or watch some of my lectures, please go to my website, mybraindurингtheday.com. So mybraindurингtheday as one word, .com. And you'll find my contact details, my lectures, and other information there.
That's great. That's mybraindurингtheday.com. And in regards to Dr. Gabby's name, it's very difficult to spell. So we will make sure that it is on our website, on the answers.network website. We'll have the spelling there for you, and that you can then type that into Amazon or wherever it is that you get your books.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Alan.
Gabby, thank you so much. Please keep up the good work. And again, for everybody out there, there are TED Talks, there are university speeches that I have seen that Gabby has done. So there's a lot of great information out there. And if you're cooped up and if you're worried about the lockdown or whatever, this is a great time to educate yourself on your own brain and on things you can do to better your life.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. And for everybody out there, please join us next Monday when we are joined by Naz Beheshti, the author of Pause, Breathe, Choose, Becoming the CEO of Your Well-Being. And in our interview, Naz will discuss the three most important elements of her book, which is Mastering Mindfulness, How to Apply Better Choices to Manage Stress and Build Resilience, and How to Successfully Promote Yourself to the CEO of Your Own Well-Being. Now, please visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network and subscribe to the show through iTunes, iHeart, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, Spreaker, SoundCloud, and many other popular podcast platforms. And if you like what you hear, if you like what you see, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people, and I'm greatly appreciated if you do that. And next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember, stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and spread the word. And know that if you spread the word of positive things out there, that's the best way that we're going to make a difference in the world. It's the best way we're going to offset a lot of the negative and divisive stuff that's out there. So, and not just my show, but any show that you find that is promoting positive things that is bettering our society, promote it. That's what's going to make change. So for everybody out there, be good humans and be with us next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.